Good morning, Hillcrest. I want to start off with a little bit of a story. The year was 1876. The place was just outside a little podunk community called Garrison in the Dakota Territories. The person was a guy named Jesse James. Got a picture of him here. Wrong Jesse James. Nope, still wrong. You didn't know Jesse Vanderwey, middle name is James. Jesse James. That's the Jesse James we're talking about. Now, Jesse James and his gang had been riding for 2 weeks trying to evade 20 lawmen that were after Jesse and his gang because his gang had failed to rob. They attempted, but they failed at it. A bank in Northfield, Minnesota, which is 230 some odd miles away. And they finally came to this place, and between them and freedom was a gap, a gorge, that was 60 feet deep and 20 feet across. And as Jesse James spun his horse around to look at the 20 men that were coming after him, he turned his horse, headed towards the gorge as fast as he could, and then he got to the edge, he leaped across this thing, 20 feet on a horse that was stolen. It was some broke down horse. Now, apparently, as the legend goes, which I found out after first service as an elementary school kid schooled me in this, apparently he was not going to make it. So he had to cut the money bags off the horse mid-flight so the horse could get more lift. Must have had wings and make it across. And apparently there is gold down in the gorge today because of that. Now, some people believe that Jesse James made this leap. In fact, if you go today into Garrison, you're going to find this place, Devil's Gulch. Now, did you guys do that or was it me? I did? I still have control. I like that. All right, so this is Devil's Gulch. And if you can see at the top of Devil's Gulch there, atop of this picture, that's where you can see the footbridge that spans the area where Jesse James apparently took this giant leap. So if you go there, you can stand there and determine for yourself whether you think he did or did not span that gorge. Well, when you are wondering this, I think it is a great illustration or example of many times in our life where we're at one place and we either want to be or someone tells us we should be at another point. And that gap in between those two ideas is what I'm going to call the gap of belief. So maybe you think, no, I can't do this, but you want to be able to do it. Or maybe you're not doing it and someone is saying you should do it. This gap of belief kind of falls in the middle of this. Now, when it comes to a gap of belief, we all have them. There are things that we believe and things that we don't believe. But when we're looking at this, you know, kind of an issue, sometimes it's something that, someone tells you. Like, someone might say, it's better to do life debt-free. Okay? Now, if you're not debt-free, to believe that you should be debt-free requires you to actually take steps to make that a reality. But that would be your gap of belief. So if you believe that, you're going to become debt-free because you're going to believe that's the right way to live. If you don't, then you're not going to be debt-free and you're never going to move across this gap because you do not believe that to be true or something that you want to believe and engage in. Sometimes these statements can be should statements, like you should this or we should this or I should this. So maybe you've heard some of these statements in our current culture today where someone would say, you know, you should support the president no matter who he or she is. Or maybe you've heard you should have children to be a productive member of society. Or maybe you've heard someone say you should see all alternate relationships as equal to traditional ones. Or someone might say you should see abortion as murder. So no matter where you are on the spectrum of whether you believe that or not, the gap of belief is the thing from wherever you're at to wherever you would want to be or someone else is trying to get you. So if I was to ask you in your own personal life, when it comes to your relationship with God, are there any gaps of belief that are difficult for you? Or are there gaps of belief that you think you should set to span that gap because your relationship with God would be better if you were able to do this thing? Okay, I don't want to overcomplicate this, but let me throw out a couple of simple ideas. Some people would say that to have a better relationship with God or a stronger relationship with God, that you should read the Bible, okay? So if that is the thing that we're pointing at, the gap of belief is whether you believe that or not, which is going to be illustrated by whether you do it or not. So if you're someone that's reading your Bible on a regular basis, you have crossed that gap, and that your gap of belief, you say, yes, it is, and that's, I've moved to the other side. Others of you are not reading your Bible every day, every week, or even every month. So you do not believe that it makes your life any better, because obviously if you did, you would do that thing. That's what a gap of belief is. So you might say, we should attend church. Well, at least all of you did today. But, you know, some people don't, right? Gap of belief, whether they believe going to church is beneficial or not. You met plenty of people that say, I don't go to church. The forest is my church, or, you know, whatever it might be. Some people would say, you know, gap of belief. They'd say, we should, you know, or you should tithe. So giving money, somehow that helps your relationship with God, someone might say. And they want you to believe that. And so that would be your gap of belief. But I don't want to just look at what these simple surface things are. In fact, I know even as I say that these are simple ones, that they're still ones that many people don't adhere to or do not believe in the way that they, you know, live it out. Any one of those things that we talked about here, like whether it's the Bible or church or tithing, probably any one of you would say, yep, we should do that. But if you're not doing it, you don't believe in it, you know? There's all kinds of gaps of belief in our world. But I want you to think of a gap of belief in your faith as it relates to your relationship with God that goes deeper than just these surface things. Something that if it's deep enough, it already answers the question for the surface items that are above it. For example, when we talked about debt. So if you would say you shouldn't get like a credit card because, you know, that's a belief. That could be one thing. You could say, you know, you shouldn't have a car loan. That'd be another thing. But the foundational piece that covers both of those is you shouldn't be in debt. Okay, so if that becomes your belief system, then all these other things, obviously a credit card and car loans and any other kind of loan would fall under that, okay? So when it comes to your relationship with God, what is something foundational that for you would help you in your relationship with God that is a foundational piece, not just a surface piece? Now, this is probably an exercise you probably haven't done before or thought a lot about. But let me give you just a moment to do that. If you open up to page 6 in the program, there's a spot in there that says, you know, my gap of belief in my relationship with God is, and try to pin something down there. No one's going to read this. I'm not going to ask you to share what you wrote. I would say there aren't right and wrong answers, but that's probably not correct in this. There probably are wrong answers. But really, it can just be your answer, okay? Gap of belief, what might that be? Let me tell you a little story about a guy named Moses. And most of you here today have heard of Moses before. Many of you have heard and understood his story. We've taught a lot about Moses over this last year. But Moses, let me give you a kind of a Cliff Notes version of his story. So Moses was born at a period of time when the Hebrew people were enslaved in Egypt. So Moses was born a Hebrew under Egyptian slavery. Now, during this period of time, the king of Egypt was getting concerned and worrying about the size of this group of Hebrew slaves, that they wanted to diminish their numbers so that they couldn't overpower the Egyptians. So the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh, he decided that they would kill the male-born children of the Hebrew families. So when Moses' mother gave birth to him, being a boy, his life was in danger at that moment. So what she did is she took Moses and she made a reed basket and then floated him in the reeds in the Nile River. And she floated Moses in the river right by the spot where the Pharaoh's daughter, the princess, would bathe at the Nile. And so as she's bathing, sure enough, Moses cries out like babies do, and the princess discovers Moses and then has compassion on him and brings him into her own family and brings him into the palace and raises Moses as her own child. Now, as Moses grows up there in Egypt, he is not oblivious to the fact that he's a Hebrew. And he knows that his people, the Hebrew people, were enslaved and they were being mistreated by the Egyptians, and very specifically, the Egyptian slave drivers. And so it was one day as he's watching one of the Hebrew slaves being beaten by this slave driver, Moses kills him. Now, this is a really bad thing for Moses to do. Murder is bad in any situation, but now Moses' life is in danger because he took the life of this Egyptian slave driver. And so Moses flees, and he takes off, he leaves Egypt, and he's out on his own. And after a considerable amount of time, a couple years go by, Moses is out in the desert, and he notices a bush that is burning. Now, that's not so strange, but the bush never gets consumed. So he goes to investigate, and when he shows up at this burning bush, of course, God speaks to Moses through this bush. And what does God say to Moses? He says, hey, Moses, I want you to go back to Egypt where your people are enslaved, where my people are enslaved, and I want you to set them free. And they're going to leave Egypt, and you're going to bring them to the promised land, the land that is their inheritance, the land flowing with milk and honey. Now, the people had already been in that land 400 years earlier, but they left it because of famine and went to Egypt to have food and to escape the devastation there in the promised land, but they never left. And over those 400 years, they became slaves, and that's the situation they're in. So Moses hears God. God says, you're going to go back. You're going to rescue the people. And then what happens to Moses? Moses has a crisis of faith. Whether he's going to believe or not, that he can do this thing that God has asked him to do. He has his own gap of belief. And if you're reading through the book of Exodus, chapters 3 and 4, you're going to see that these chapters are the chapters that illustrate and show this gap of belief that Moses has. He just is really struggling to believe that he really can do this thing. So I'm not going to read each one of the verses, but I will reference the verses to kind of show you just a snapshot of some of the complaining, arguing, discussion that Moses has with God. So in chapter 3, verse 11, God says, you know, I want you to go do this thing. And Moses says, yeah, but who am I? Like, why would I be able to do this? Like, how am I capable to do this? Like, there's a lot of other capable people, but like, why would I be able to do this? I'm not good enough. I'm not able enough. Like, why me? So kind of a little bit of a defense there. God answers that question. Moses goes on in verse 13. He says, what if others don't believe in you? Okay, so first we got the why me, but now what if people don't believe in you? I say, God has sent me. What if these people don't even believe in you? What would I do then? So again, another concern that he has. In fact, he even says, who would I even say that you are? And again, God answers that question for him. And then Moses in chapter 4, verse 1, he says, well, what if they don't believe me? What if they don't believe what I'm saying? Maybe they don't believe that I was standing in front of this bush and that you actually said to do this. What if they don't believe me? God answers that. Verse 10, Moses says, okay, we've answered all the questions, but seriously, God, like, I'm a bad communicator. I can't do public speaking. My tongue gets tied up. I'm just bad at communicating ideas. Like, I can't do this. I'm just not wired for this. God answers that. In verse 13, Moses is left with the only defense he has. He says, just send someone else. Like, do you get it, God? Like, I was a Hebrew. I abandoned my people. And when it comes to the Egyptians, I killed an Egyptian. I'm a murderous fugitive on the run. If I go back there, I'm dead. Like, there are better, I think, a murderer on the run. There's got to be a better option, right? Somebody other than me. He says, just send anyone but me. But God wants it to be Moses who goes. So Moses has this crisis of faith, and there's this gap of belief. Will he actually be able to do the thing that God called him to do? The gap is in front of him. To jump that gap, there's risk, there's unknowns, but does he have the faith it takes to jump that gap to find himself on the other side where God needs him to be, or will he refuse and not jump the gap? Well, you know the story, sure enough, Moses jumps the gap. It didn't go without problem. It's not that Moses had perfect faith from that day forward, but he did some amazing things because God asked him to do it. You can almost hear throughout this whole text, God kind of saying, are you for real? Like, what? Why do you say I don't know if I can do it if I'm the one asking you to do it? Like, I will provide for you if I'm asking you. I will protect you if I'm asking you. My will be done if I'm asking you to do this thing. But Moses keeps having all the questions. So Moses did do some great things. But he had a hard time, even doing those, at times, believing in the things that God was telling him. You see, Moses believed early on that he was worthless. Moses believed that he was ill-equipped, unable. Moses believed that he was unable to do the thing that God was saying he could. Hindsight's 20/20, but Moses couldn't see it at that time. I think when I look at this story, I look at us and I say there's got to be these things in our life. We're the same way, in the way that God is asking us to do some things. Well, Moses became a great man of faith. And he grew in his faith and did some amazing things. And as we as a church move into our next season of ministry, that next chapter for Hillcrest, what will that include? What are the things, this gap of faith between where we are and where God wants us to be, and will we be able as a community to jump that gap? Will we take the risk? Will we do what we need to do? When we look back over Hillcrest's history of 73 years, we can see many gaps of faith along the way that people jumped, where they took great risk or made great sacrifice, and we have benefited from that, and the community has benefited from that. I've seen many people come to faith through the ministry here at Hillcrest. I've seen people find purpose in their life where they didn't find it before. I see people who find hope that didn't have hope. And we can point to these things. But as we unfold the next chapter, we can't just rest on what has been done, but we must look ahead to what God is up to. And as he puts that next challenge before us, can we jump that gap that he puts before us? I do believe that Hillcrest is ready to step into what I would call our actual purpose for our existence. The exact reason why we are a church, and not just us, but why the church exists at all. This thing that I believe God is asking us to do and asking his church globally to do, that there is only about 5, depending on how you look at it, maybe 10% of churches that are even doing this thing that I believe God is asking us to do and is part of our next chapter as a church. And it's not because these churches or even us don't know that we're supposed to do this thing. We do know it, but we have chosen not to do it because the gap of belief is too great, too much risk, too much whatever it might be. Maybe even trying to tell ourselves that we don't have to jump that gap, that somehow we are absolved from the responsibility to jump it, but we all would know what that is. So I want to show it to you, and it's probably not going to be rocket science. It's this, that Jesus asks us to share our faith. See, it's not rocket science. It's not like, you're not like, wow, it's a new concept. Everybody knows that. Everybody knows that that's what God asks us to do. But I know that even as I say it, as you read those words on the screen, most people will immediately reject it. You'll automatically, without even having to think about it, justify and rationalize why it's not for you to do. Some way you'll relieve yourself of any responsibility. We've conditioned ourselves to do this in the church, and that's why there's such the problem there is in the church in America specifically. And when you look at what Jesus said to us about this idea, he says it to all of us, individually. Mark chapter 16, verse 15, Jesus says this. He says, and then he told them, go into all the world and preach the good news to everyone. Go into all the world and preach the good news to everyone. Now, when people generally read this verse of what Jesus said, they say, well, okay, Pastor Doug, now that verse is referring to the who? Starts with a C. The church, right? That's the church. Like, that's not me, that's the church. The minute anyone tells a pastor, oh, that's for the church, I want you to know all you're doing is revealing to the pastor that you don't know the definition of the word. Because a church is not an institution of itself. It's not an organization. It's not a club. It's not an address. It's not a building. Okay? The church is what? It's individuals. And those individuals, when they come together, we call it a church. But a church is not anything separate from the individuals within it. So every command that God gives to us as a church is for us individually. And you can't wash that away and say it's for some other person within the church, because the church is only the church because we're all in it, and the commands are for all of us within the church. And this command to go into all the world is not specific to some office or some specific group or someone that has one particular gift versus another. It's for all of us to go into all the world and preach the good news to everyone. Now, the Barna Group did some research this past May, and it was a follow-up on research that they had done many years ago in 1993. They wanted some new data on this, and the data happened to match exactly to what we are talking about today. I want to show you this data because, you know, I don't just make this stuff up. This is real stuff that the Christian church in America is thinking about and how the Christian church is interacting with this. It shouldn't be too surprising to you, but as of today, 100% of evangelicals in the church today believe that Christians are to share their faith. There is no dispute on this. Everybody says, it's not like there's a faction of Christianity that's like, oh no, he doesn't want us to share our faith. Everybody says, yes, he wants Christians to share their faith, okay? So I would doubt that there would be anyone here today that would disagree that Christians are supposed to share their faith. But the data that follows 100% of Christians in America saying this is confusing. Because the next piece of data is that when you talk to these people that say, yes, it's the responsibility of Christians, 34% of them say it's the job of the church to do it, which is their way of saying it's not my job. So 34% of people say it isn't my job, it's like a program. It's the pastor's job, it's the elder's job, it's a deacon's job, it's somebody else's job, it's people on the outreach team, it's something else. It's the church's responsibility, but not me personally, okay, 34%. Now here's a striking figure. When you look at this same data back in 1993, one of the pieces of data is the same. 100% of people said it is the responsibility of Christians to share their faith. But instead of 34% saying it was the church's responsibility, it was 11%. So from 93 to today, look at the jump. 11% said it's a church's responsibility. Today, 34% say it's a church's responsibility. And this is an alarming number that's growing. Because we're detaching ourselves from it, taking less responsibility and putting it on something else that doesn't even exist, because the thing we're trying to put it on is ourselves, the church. But we're making it someone other than us. Now, if this number wasn't bad enough, because you would say, well, if 34% say it's the church's responsibility, that would mean, what's the other percentage? That'd be 66%, right, would be doing it. Well, that's not the case either, because today, only 19% of Christians in the church today have shared their faith ever. That's not like just 19% do it once a week or once a month or once a year. That means 19% of that 19%, maybe somebody did it one time 15 years ago. Only 19% of people in the church today are sharing their faith with someone else. And that number is the most devastating piece of news, I think, for the church today. This is difficult for us to have to deal with. I would say that we are failing in what is even more important than a life and death situation, because this is an eternal situation. Our faith, heaven, eternity. I mean, would you accept 19% in things that are life and death in your world? 19% of airplanes will make it to their destination. Anybody going to fly in a plane with 19% chance? 19% chance that your surgeon will not kill you on the operating table. No thanks, appendix is just fine ruptured. Better chance with that than under the knife with you. None of us would accept 19%. But we have a world out there who doesn't know the love of Christ, and there's only a 19% chance that someone's going to tell them about Jesus. And we're satisfied with that. Or are we? It's God that tells us that we need to share our faith. In fact, God would go as far as to say, you know what, when you're living your life connected to me, it's going to ooze out of all parts of your life. And when that happens, people are going to notice it, they're going to be drawn to it, and they're going to ask, what's different about you? What is it about you that is so different from everyone else? How do you have joy in the midst of pain? You know, how can you be a person that cares about others and not just about yourself? How come you didn't take that opportunity to kind of undercut that person and get that raise or that promotion at work? I know you could have done it and you didn't. What's different about you? In fact, God says it this way in 1 Peter 3:15. He says, instead, you must worship Christ as Lord of your life. So that's when he's in the full part of who you are. He says, and if someone asks you about your Christian hope, always be ready to explain it. Always be ready to share about your faith, because as you're living a life of faith, people are going to ask about that. Now, I'm going to say something this morning that is inflammatory, and I realize some of you are thinking, yeah, Pastor, you've already said some of those things. I realize that this will probably fall more into that category, and I don't mean it to be that way, but I know that it's going to hit that way for some of you. If you're I apologize. I don't have all these fill-ins in your program today. I changed some before after our printing was done. But here's the statement that I want to be sure we get across today. And that's that if you won't share your faith, then you have false faith. I wouldn't want someone to say that to me. What right do I have to say something like that? If I don't share my faith with others, I have a false faith. I'd be offended by that. I would challenge us with this. If you truly believed that the faith that you have is what has transformed your life and your eternity, how could you possibly keep that to yourself in a world that's looking for that same answer everywhere? For example, let's say there was a table that had two cups of water on it, okay? Two separate cups of water. And people could come up to it that are thirsty, and they could drink the water. But you knew that the one on the right was poison. And if they drank it, they would die immediately, okay? So think of someone you love. Someone you love comes up to the table. They look at both glasses. They make a 50-50 shot. They grab one and they start to drink it. What would you say? Yeah, stop. Don't. Don't drink that. It's poison, right? You'd stop them because you care about them. and you don't want this devastation to happen to them? What if it's someone you don't even know? Just some random stranger comes up to the table and starts to grab the poison. Would you say, it's not my business what glass they drink out of? Right? Could you stand there and watch that? Of course, not the same thing, right? You'd say, don't drink that. What if they said, who are you to tell me what to drink? I'll drink it if I want to drink it. Then would you say, hey, good luck with that? No, you'd probably knock it out of their hand. Like, you don't want to watch them die. Now, that's an exaggeration of what I'm talking about. But at the same point, I want to get the point across that we have within us this thing that brings life here and in the life to come. And if we don't share it with anyone, I'm afraid we don't even have it in the first place. Because if it's not valuable to us, why would we share it with someone else? But if it truly was life-changing, life-transforming, we would share that. So I think if we don't share our faith, I think the faith that we think that we have is a false faith. And the church in America, I am sorry to say, has grown fat and lazy. And she has numbed her mission with fancy programs, lighting, pallet walls, and busy work. That it's all about the things that we do, and we have the mentality that you must come to get it instead of the go and tell type of commissioning that God has called us to do. That if you don't come into this place, if you don't come and hear a sermon, then there's no hope for you. But to go out and to tell, that we don't do. And the church in America has gotten lazy about this and said, let's just make everything as flashy and as exciting and as fun as we possibly can, but they've got to come here to get it. We won't inconvenience ourselves or take a risk to share our faith outside the walls in our neighborhood, in our work, at our school, in our family. And I want you to know that in your life, there are dozens of people that God has put there for you to share your faith with. Dozens of people that he has put in your life for only you to share with. Because I believe that he interacts with you the exact same way he did with Moses. And though Moses had all the excuses, I don't have the right words, what about me, what if they don't believe in you, all this stuff that Moses said, we can say the exact same thing. And I think God would say, if I have put someone in your path that doesn't know about me, I have equipped you to be able to say it. I've equipped you to have all that you need in this relationship to help them know who I am. And we can argue it, but it's just like Moses, right? But God has put those in our paths, and he equips us and he prepares us. Because I believe that God has given you eyes to see it. I believe he has given you a heart that beats for the things that God cares about. But you're the one that has to take the step and actually do it. And this claim that we don't want to share this thing that we call the good news is something that just drove Jesus nuts. And he said these words to his disciples. He said to his disciples, the harvest is great, but the workers are few. So pray to the Lord who is in charge of the harvest and ask him to send more workers into the fields. It's Jesus is the one that saves people. It's Jesus that reveals himself to people. But the workers in the field are a part of the work of the harvest. God is the God of the harvest, but he's asked us to go into the fields and to do the work, the cultivation that takes place. Now, I realize I am not dense with this. I realize that all I have done today is create a sense of guilt in probably everyone here. And I want you to know that is not my intent, and that is not healthy, and that is not good for you to sense or to be feeling guilt right now. So, you see, if you're feeling guilt, that can kind of manifest itself into a couple different ways. It can become resentment and anger when you feel guilt. Sometimes guilt can drive you to rationalization or justification for things that you're doing. In the best scenario, guilt will move you can move you to positive action, but it will be very short-lived because it's fueled by guilt. And, well, guilt's not a good motivator. I believe that we need something much better than guilt today. So let me take a little bit of pressure off you. You all have asked me to be your pastor, to spend time during the week to study the scriptures and to come up with something that we can teach on Sunday that helps us be closer to God and know how to interact with God in our world and to love other people. And to do that in a way that we can understand, that is applicable, that we can relate to in some way. And as I do that week in and week out, today, if you are not aware that you are to share your faith, or you don't have this passion to share your faith, I want you to know that's on me. Okay? That's on me. That means I have done a poor job of communicating this. I've done a poor job of preparing you and readying you for this, or even letting you know that this is something that you're called to do. Now, certainly you could find this out on your own as you read the scriptures, but it's also a responsibility that I have in my teaching to communicate these things. And once we have that responsibility and we know, we become responsible for that. And I do believe that the next chapter for Hillcrest has this in mind. And though only 5 or 10% of churches in America are even doing this, I believe that Hillcrest is ready for this next step, as scary and as difficult as it is. And the reason why I believe that is because of what happened on April 1st, Easter Sunday here. You all changed me that Sunday. And I realized that you are ready for things that I had no idea. And as scary as this next step is, I believe you are ready for it. I believe God is calling us to this. Now, even as I say this, I realize that some of you are a little worried about what this might be. But let me ease your fears a little bit. If you believe that sharing your faith means standing on a street corner with a bullhorn yelling at people about Jesus and that they're going to hell and need to be saved, you couldn't be further from the truth. That is not what I'm asking you to do. That will not be required of you. If you believe that you're going to need to confront someone, no. If you believe that you're going to have to tell someone or convince them in some way that they're going to hell, no. If you believe that you're going to have to go to seminary to get an education and know all the right answers on who Jesus is and what salvation is, that's not true either. In fact, you'll have less answers coming out of seminary than when you went in. I'm telling you that in order to share your faith with someone, you will not even be required to pray the sinner's prayer with someone. It's not that you wouldn't. That's not what I'm talking about. Because all of those things are things that we have lumped on top of this share our faith. But those aren't the things that Jesus taught. And as your pastor, I'm committed to teaching you what Jesus taught. And you may find a strategy or a way or some process that fits well for you and your world and your view of things. But Jesus taught salvation in such a simple way. He taught hope and good news in such a simple way, and he did it through relationship. So in sharing your faith, all I'm going to ask you to do is to engage in relationship. Now, how we do that, where we do that, what that looks like, these are the things we're going to be talking about over the next months and next year together. As we uncover this next chapter of how to share our faith with other people and to do it the way Jesus did it in relationship. Because together I believe that we truly can do what God asks us to do, which is to love other people. And the reason why we love them is because we want to be in relationship with them, because God loves them and he loves us. And in that love, we will find ways to serve people. And we'll find ways to care for people. And in love, we will help people. And when we're loving people, we will be able to listen to them because we're in relationship with them and to be present with them and to cry with them and to laugh with them and to celebrate with them and to mourn with them. It's just called relationship. Because love changes people. And the kind of love that God asks us to show to the world changes the world. And it's his love that saves. And it's his love that forgives. And it's his love that accepts. In fact, I believe that it is love from you that will move those you love to loving God. And I really hope that this is a gap of belief that you can hold on to, grab a hold of, and take a leap with me. To look into your world and to love. Because God first loved you. That the gap isn't too far for you to be able to jump. Because I believe that this is our calling as a church. And this is our work. To love. There's a verse when you walk into the sanctuary that's actually painted over the doors. And it is this. In the same way, let your good deeds shine out for all to see, so that everyone will praise your heavenly Father. Because as we love people through building meaningful relationships, they will see God. It's not easy work. There's a lot of risk to it. But I hope that sharing your faith is going to look radically different than what so many people try to tell you it is. That it's a kind of thing that makes a radical impact in the lives of those that you love and care about, and a world that is so desperately looking for this hope. And so we're going to close with a song that wraps up this idea of what people are looking for, what we need and what we're looking for, and those that have been far from God, what they're looking for. So I invite you to sing with us and make this your prayer as we close our time together. Jacob.